G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter U, dot org. And I'm Jono. Joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
Hey, Jono. How are you?
Very good, my newly wedded friend. How was it?
That's great. Still on my honeymoon.
Yes, still on your honeymoon. Just tell everyone again what happened.
So, one of the things that, Lori and I actually got married originally November was 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that happened was we never really got married in a Jewish ceremony. And mm-hmm. That's something that really has always bothered us. And so in conversation with my rabbi Moshe Goldsmith in Itamar, who some of your listeners have listened to on Truth to You, he said, we have to change that. We have to do something about that. And he came in recently, a few weeks back, to do a tour of the States, a speaking tour. Mm. And what we did was we set up something down in South Florida, about 3 hours south of where I live, at a synagogue down there. And 2 weeks ago this morning, Sunday morning here in the States, Lori and I got married by Rabbi Moshe and Rabbi Ben Chamu, who's a Sephardic rabbi down there as well, who actually is a Dayan. He's actually a judge that's recognized by the rabbinate in Israel. So it was really very special. We had a really wonderful time, and it was just great. Very, very special. Very spiritually significant for us.
Sure. Great. Well, I'm glad it all went well. And is Rabbi Moshe Goldsmith, is he still here, or has he gone back to Itamar? Or
no, Rabbi Moshe is back in Itamar. They left on Wednesday, this past Wednesday, and got home on Thursday. And so, he's back. I spoke to him briefly the other day, they're now trying to recuperate. They just got into the swing of things for the two weeks they were here. That happened. So, you travel somewhere like that, and it takes you a good week to 2 weeks to get over the jet lag, and then they went back. So now it's trying to recover from the, from their recovery.
And are they still knee-deep in snow in Itamar, or?
Well, I mean, they actually missed that. And what was terrible was their younger son, Ephraim, both their older son Yosef and their younger son Ephraim are both special forces in the IDF, special units. And Ephraim was scheduled for his wilderness training during that week. And, and they do not cancel that. And so that basically means that, he gets sent out there into the wilderness and left by himself, not with a unit. He's there by himself alone and has to make his way navigating and fending for himself. And so that has to be really tough in that in those weather conditions.
Yeah, he was all right, right?
He was okay. Yeah, he was fine. Yeah, they got back, and of course, because of the elevation, there is still some stuff on the ground, but for the most part, that storm has passed, I believe.
Wow. So because that's quite high. I'm hoping to visit Itamar and visit them when I get over there in the first couple of weeks of March for the 3T tour with Keith Johnson. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, you're going to have some great weather during that time, and you're really going to be blown away by the community in general. But, I want to get there as well. That's like one of our first stops when we get over there in July, just to go spend some time with Moshe and Leah. But I think you're
so
really
it's July now for you. It's July now for you. You and I aren't going to be there together.
No, I mean, what we really had to sit down and think about it, and financially, it just didn't make any sense for us to go earlier than our Aliyah, because it really is an expensive trip, as you know. And so to take that amount of money, which probably, when you think about it, will cover the cost of our shipping of the stuff that we ship over from the States, it didn't really make sense to put that money into a trip to Israel when, we would be moving there in 3 or 4 months.
When there are, the order of priorities couldn't juggle that. So I'm going to miss you when I get there, unfortunately. We'll hook up sometime later in the future, no doubt. But at the moment, my friend, we're on Skype and we're doing Treasures from the Tanakh, and we are in Job chapter 24. Shall we kick off?
Absolutely.
Well, so Job continues here because last time we spoke, Ira, 23, Job was was replying to, who was he replying to? Eliphaz. And he continues here, but we get to find out a few things in this chapter. It's a little bit different. We find out about the social structure, some of the struggles that are going on in Job's society, in the community in which he lives. Some of the, like, I suppose, the darker side of...
I know, I was going to say, that's an interesting thing that you would bring that up, because there's actually several different opinions on that.
Yeah, there is, and when we get to verse 18 and on, it's a little bit. There are some different opinions, aren't there?
Actually, for me, it starts in verse 13, but because in verse 13 is where we really start to see a switch. We see the first 12 verses as a section, and then from 13 to like 21 or 22 or 24 kind of has its own.
There is some mystery about the voice of or the intention of some of these verses. So we're going to get to them, and it begins like this. It says, "Job starts. He says, since times are not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who know Him not see His days?" Well, first of all, what?
Yeah, exactly. What in the world? So actually. The first word that we see in that verse is madua, and it means why. Okay, so what's happening is he's really asking a question here, and I believe it's a continuation from the last chapter. And he basically, what I see is madua mishadai lo nitzpnu itim, and what he's saying is why, and I see that as one word, not like all connected. Mm-hmm. Like he's just saying why, and then he says from Shaddai. Are his times not hidden or concealed, and they that know him do not behold his days? So that sounds a little bit different than what you said. It really is one of those really difficult passages, but there's context here that we have to introduce, and I think when we introduce a context, we'll be able to better understand why I'm translating it the way I am, direct from the Hebrew. As mm-hmm. opposed to what you see typically in the English translation. And I think that's part of the problem. The English translators are like saying, what? If you go back and you think about what you said, which is that Eliphaz is the one that we last heard from in chapter mm-hmm. 22, before mm-hmm. Job started speaking, we see a connection actually in his first speech in Job chapter 15, verse 20. Where Eliphaz was speaking, and actually there's the same word used. Actually, in that verse, it says, "Kol yemei rasha hu mitcholel umespar shanim nitzpenu le'aritz." And we see that word nitzpenu again. So we see that word that's translated either concealed or hidden. Or reserved, and in Job 15:20, we see that idea where it's translated as the wicked man rides in torment all his days. Few years are reserved for the ruthless, which could be hidden or concealed. It could be translated that same way. So when we look at it in that way, all of these interactions that we've had with Eliphaz, and even in Job's last couple of speeches, we see this constant discussion on the wicked. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to see that again here. When we connect all of this with the last, with a couple of the ending verses in Job 23, what do we read? In Job 23, 16 and 17, I think we get an answer, or not an answer, but we get the reason why he's saying why. Because in 23:16 and 17, it says, "And God has made me faint-hearted. Shaddai mm-hmm. has terrified me, yet I am not destroyed or cut off from the face of darkness, and from my face he has covered darkness." Mm-hmm. And so in essence, for me, the way this chapter is starting is that Job is wondering why the times of his suffering were not hidden away or concealed, meaning I know him. And he can understand why this would be with the wicked, which he's going to describe here, and where he's described in other places as well. Because the idea is that if that God would hide away or conceal these things, then his friends would not be seeing him in the predicament that he's in now.
Right, and that seems to be. I mean, I'm just looking at the new JPS, the NJPS, and it says it interprets it this way. It says, "Why are times for judgment not reserved by Shaddai? Even those close to him cannot foresee his actions."
Right,
I think that's probably better. Interesting.
It's a better. All right, so. It's definitely a better translation. But I think, as again, what we're going to see is, you know, he's going to make a distinction in this chapter again between his position on how the wicked are treated as opposed to what he's going through.
Mm-hmm. Let me go from 2 to 4, and this is some of the revealing things that are happening during the time of Job. Some remove landmarks. They seize flocks violently and feed on them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox as a pledge. You mentioned that.
Well, we spoke about that.
They push the needy off the road, Ira. All the poor of the land are forced to hide. Indeed, like wild donkeys in the desert, they go out to their work searching for food.
Mm-hmm.
The wilderness yields food for them and for their children. So these are some of the things that are going on, apparently.
Right. So we don't even see him making a change. You know, he just basically, you know, we basically have him asking this question, why, and then he goes right into discussing, you know, obviously he's discussing the wicked again.
Mm.
They overtake borders, or I think you said boundary stones.
They remove landmarks. Yeah, that's what I've got. They remove boundary stones. They seize flocks violently and feed. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. So all of these things are. It's interesting because as we look in the Torah, there's something for each of these.
Absolutely.
So they're clearly infringing on the law of God and the instruction of God. And it goes, but then it's from 5 on, he talks about the, he switches from the wicked and some of the wicked things that are happening and starts to talk about the poor. Shall I read that?
Right. But so what we see in just these few verses that you read, you know, when it says that they turn aside the needy from the way, together the poor of the land need to hide themselves, you know, basically what we're talking about is I'm trying to think of maybe a reference to this, you know, in a modern day, like, you know, sometimes you see, like, you know, we have that old character, Simon Legree, that would come to the widow and, you know, demand the money, or he was going to take her house away. You know, it kind of has that connotation that the poor and the needy would actually have to take back roads and side streets to avoid confrontation with these, you know, these wicked, wealthy people that were even taking, you know, taking advantage of them for no reason. You know, wild asses in the wilderness, basically, you know, wild asses are in, and especially in that area, in the land around Israel, or on the continent of Africa, they are indigenous. African, there is the African wild ass.
Yeah.
And they thrive in the most inhospitable environment. Think about that. And what's interesting about them, and we're going to see how this is really a very interesting metaphor that's going on here, because one of the things that we're going to see described is how these evil people operate, you know, in the daytime and the nighttime and so forth. And one of the things that's amazing about this is that primarily the wild ass is active only in the cooler hours between the late afternoon and the early morning. So they operate in that cover of darkness that we're going to see spoken about later on the chapter. And what they do is they seek shade and shelter during the rocky hills during the day. So they don't really do anything during the day. They hang out and just kind of like we're going to read about here.
So he cuts from the wicked and he focuses on the poor for the next three verses, the five which I read. Indeed, like the wild donkey in the desert, they go out to their work searching for food. Then it says, hang on, but whoa. See, are you likening 5, verse 5, with the wicked or with the poor?
No, I'm likening verse 5 with the wicked, and so am I with verse 6 as well.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I read this differently, because with 4, okay, so what I read is 2, 3, and 4, he's talking about the wicked. From 5, because he says they in 4, they push the needy off the road and the poor of the land are forced to hide. Then I thought from here on he was talking about the poor, saying, indeed, like wild donkeys in the desert, they go out to their work searching for food. The wilderness yields food for them and for their children. They gather their fodder in the field. They glean in the vineyard of the wicked.
I would translate it as, and the vineyard, and in the vineyard, the wicked they grab. What I would say is that what's happening there is that the wicked don't even allow the gleanings to remain for the poor there.
Really,
is the way I would translate it. And when you said the Torah, comparing that to Torah, I would certainly say that speaks about, yeah, because that word, that last word that we see in the verse. It says Basadeb Lilo Yiktsoru the Kerem Rasha Yilakshu. And so it's saying in the field they harvest the fodder, and the vineyard the wicked they grab, and that Laksho, this grabbing relates to, as it relates to the vineyard, those late grapes, the ones that are still remaining, that are supposed to be not gleaned, according to Torah in Deuteronomy 24:19-22, we very clearly see that, you know, there's that command to
not go over the second time, but to leave, you know, whatever's left.
When you reap the harvest in your field and overlook a sheaf in the field, do not turn back to get it. It shall go to the strange or the fatherless. And that's why I say this should go to who? To the strange or the fatherless and the widow, in order that the Lord God may bless you in all your undertakings. When you beat that fruit of your olives, do not go over them again. They shall go to the strange or the fatherless and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, do not pick it over again, so that it shall go to the strange or the fatherless and the widow. Always remember that you are a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I enjoin you to observe this commandment. So I see it like that, and then I see the change.
In verse 7, because I was going to say, how do you understand? So there's a different way of reading the and there are. This is, as I said, this is in some places a mysterious chapter, and there's different ways of reading it. We can get into that as we go. But
the whole book is a mysterious book.
There's an example of that. But you think it switches in 7. They spend the night naked without clothing and have no covering in the cold. They are wet with the showers of the mountains and huddle around the rock for want of shelter. Now, verse 7 and 8, you think is certainly in respects to the poor and the needy of the land.
Yeah, basically what's happening is they're talking about what, you know, that they don't leave anything for the poor and needy. They leave them naked. They're, you know, they have these mountain, you know, rainfalls that come down. Mm-hmm. Even so much so that there's no shelter for them, that they leave them without shelter, and they're huddling against rocks, you know, to try and protect themselves from the weather.
And so from verse 9, do you see that it switches back to focus, Job switches back to focus on the wicked?
Yes.
That's what I see as well. We agree there. Some snatch the fatherless from the breast and take a pledge from the poor. They cause the poor to go naked without clothing, and they take away the sheaves from the hungry. So he's reiterating, really.
And I'll tell you why. I don't think so. I'm going to tell you why. Because if you look at verse 7, it would appear to us that verse 7 and verse 10 are saying exactly the same thing. You know, this idea of going about naked without clothing. But one was talking about nighttime. It's talking about, it starts out in verse 7 that they lay naked, or they stay naked overnight without clothing, have no covering in the cold, and then they protect themselves from this weather. And then we go into this verse 10 and these next verses that speak about, you know, their work, them being put
the
to
work, which is conducted during the day.
Yeah, and it almost talks about this idea that it's as if they take the children, when it's talking about in the verse 3-4, they rob the orphan from the breast and take a pledge of the poor. And then it goes into this idea, so that they go about naked without clothing and being hungry, they carry the sheaves. It's meaning that they kind of put these people to hard labor, and they're even taking their children and sending them out to work as well.
So we have oppression, we have thefts, we have kidnapping so far. Mm-hmm. And it goes on in 11, they press out oil within their walls and tread wine presses, yet suffer thirst. Now, again, have we switched over to the poor in 11?
Well, it's talking about what they do. Yeah, it's talking, this is that hard labor. It's the first we talk about the idea that they're carrying the sheaves. In other words, they're making them go out and work the harvest. Now it's, you know, within their walls, it actually, it's talking about terraces. You know, the, in vineyards, they're usually terraces. And so that's what's being spoken there, between the terraces or between the walls of the levels of the vineyard. They press soil, they tread wine presses. It's almost like saying, we sand them out, we make them carry the sheaves, we make them carry the harvest and the grain, we make them carry the grapes or the grapes, we make them do this oil, but we don't allow them to eat any of it. We don't allow them to drink any of it. They remain hungry and they remain thirsty, even though we
put this grain. And there's Torah, even in regards to the ox, do not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. So how much more for a human being? And verse 12 is interesting. It goes on to say, the dying groan in the city and the souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not charge them with wrong.
Yeah, God does not charge them with wrong.
Now, I've got them in italics, right? But the them that's insinuated there surely is the wicked.
Yeah, it's talking about the wicked. And it's the word that's typically, actually the word that we translate there is actually means unseemliness. So a literal translation would say something like, from the city men they groan, and the soul of the slain cries out, and Eloah does not set unseemliness. And really what it's talking about, that he doesn't charge them with wrongdoing. And this is one of the things, remember, that Job has been complaining about. He's been complaining about all throughout this idea of the wicked prospering while he's suffering, and here are all my friends coming against me and telling me that I'm wicked and I'm evil and all I have to do is repent and I know I'm righteous, and I'm going to tell you what the wicked are really like. What I see is really interesting, and I have to stop here for a minute because this is one of my pet peeves that I have to talk about. And because the word happens to be in here. In verse 12. So, you know, one of the things that that all of us have experienced, anybody who's been involved at all with the Messianic movement, the Hebrew Roots movement, Christianity, is this constant bickering over the proper pronunciation of the name of God. And of course, you know, you and I have been involved in that as well, having, you know, me having worked at least a little bit with finding some of the areas in the manuscripts where the we see the full vowel points of the name. Certainly the book that Keith wrote, certainly all the work that Nehemiah has done, you know, is kind of spearheading all of this work. For those people that have come to the conclusion that the full vowel pointings always point to one particular pronunciation, Yehovah. And there are many people that hold to that. And the thing is that we've spent enough time explaining why we believe that that's the proper pronunciation, because obviously it has the proper root of the verb hayah, to be. You know, hayah, hoveh, yehiyeh, the idea of that he was, he is, and he will be. but it's this idea of the construct that we see that happens so many times. So one of the things, just go over this really quickly. One of the things that we get as an argument all the time, and quite frankly, it's always an argument from people that don't know Hebrew. And there are tons of those out here, and out there. People that don't know Hebrew, and they say, well, it's not possible to pronounce the name that way because Hovah means destruction.
Destruction.
And we don't want to say that God is destruction.
I love this. A wonderful example of a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing.
Oh, can it? You know. So they say Hovah means destruction, and they're right, Hovah does mean destruction. The problem with their lack of knowledge and their ignorance is that Hovah is the root Hevav-Hey, whereas the name of God is based under Hey Yud Hey Hayah, not Hey Vav Hey. And yet the very thing that they complain about is the very thing that they do themselves, because one of the great ridiculous constructs that these people have come up with is this idea of referring to Jesus in wanting to attribute, I guess, divinity or deity to him, calling him Yahshua. Okay, by placing the Yah, which is a poetic form of the name of God, with Shua, instead of calling him Yeshua, which would be the Hebrew for Yeshua. And here's the problem with that. What do we see in verse 12? We see it says in verse 12 in the Hebrew, Me'il mitim inaku v'nefesh chalalim tishavea v'eloha lo yasim tfila tifla. That word that we see there, tishavea, is from the root verb shua, and why we translated it as nefesh chalalim tishavea means, and the soul of the slain cries out. As I said, the root of that is shua, which means to cry out or to cry for help.
If you do a
Tanakh word search on that word, on that root, you will find it many, many times, but you'll never once see God crying out to anybody. It will always be people crying out to God.
Oh, and what you're saying, hang on, okay, so if I understand what you're saying, those who believe that Yeshua is the Messiah and so on and so forth, who refer to him as Yahshua, is actually saying Yehovah cries out.
Right. So what we're basing in this kind of context, what we're basically saying is that these people have made up a ridiculous construct that borders on blasphemy, because what they're basically saying is that Yah, God, Yehovah, cries out for help. And who would he cry out to is the big question for me. So the very thing that they do by not understanding Hebrew and looking in and saying and thinking that Yehovah is somehow a construct of
and means destruction, and therefore it can't possibly be right. Yeah.
They in turn do that very same thing
to their own Messiah or their rabbi or whatever it may be, for those who pronounce it that way. So I can understand why that's a little bit frustrating, but you can't tell them. I've had discussions with people who insist that this is the way that it's pronounced, and sometimes it's like banging your head against a brick wall, but there's an example.
Look, they can insist all they want. I mean, you know, there are children that insist when you come home and find something broken on the floor that they weren't the ones that broke it either, you know, that some monster walked in the room and knocked off the vase from the table. So, you know, but we all know that that's a ridiculous concept. And so they can bang their heads and stomp their feet and have tantrums all they want. They're wrong. You know, go out and get a Hebrew education. And if you don't like it, don't listen to my show anymore. That's the bottom line. The bottom line. Go out and get a Hebrew education before you try to teach those of us that know what we're talking about.
There it is in verse 12. Now, incidentally, I've got in the NJPS, men groan in the city, so the souls of the dying cry out, yet God does not regard it as reproach. I've got reproach there. He doesn't regard it as reproach. In other words, you know, doesn't he see this? Shouldn't he be taking action? He doesn't take action. Therefore, what? He doesn't regard it as something
I said, it's really not, that's not, reproach is not a good word there. As I said, the word there is tifla, and tifla, it could have many different translations. It can mean stupidity. It can mean silliness. You know, again, it's based on the context, but For the most part, it means to ascribe unseemliness.
Unseemliness.
But in the sense,
Ira, that he is tolerant of such goings on, and this is Job's complaint.
Yeah, basically, what he's saying is that he's asking why there's why he does not charge them with wrongdoing.
And so what I've got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say.
This is what happens when there's a slight delay. You continue.
All right. No, I was just going to say that we have this whole situation where he's attributing all these different things to these people, you know, that are oppressing the poor and the needy and the fatherless and so forth. Mm. And then he's saying that I don't understand how that the people are groaning from the cities. And when it says from the city, men, they groan, that idea of city, he's not just talking about a town or a village. He's like talking about, you know, like where there's a populated area that people are groaning, that the souls of the slain, you know, it could even mean those who haven't even died yet, like him, like people who are almost at death because of the oppression. Sure. There is a possibility to translate it that way as well. that it's not just necessarily talking about people who have died already. It could be in context talking about these people that are almost at death because of the way they're being oppressed, that they cry out and yet God does nothing, is what Job
said. So what I've got in the study notes of my New King James Nelson study Bible, it says, verse 12, in this transition between lists of social crimes and criminal acts, Job protests against God ignoring those who cry out for help, since God was supposedly ignoring his own cries for help.
Exactly.
So that's pretty fair. That's not bad. There's a point for the study notes. So it goes on to say, and there's a shift here, is what you were saying from.
So
verse
this
13.
Is what I yeah. So for me, so I want to introduce the two perspectives here because I think there's an interesting shift here, and there's actually two different interpretations, you know, from the Jewish sages that talk mm-hmm. about these verses, and one of them actually believes that this is speaking about the generation of the flood.
When we see
verse 13 on, that it's speaking about the generation of the flood, and that Job is saying at the end of verse 12 that in spite of the wickedness, that God does not bring blame upon them, and yet I know that he's able to punish by seeing the severity of the wickedness of this earlier generation, and then asks the question, if so, why does he now allow the wicked to prosper?
So let me go from 13 to 17. Is that okay? Because I think that's a block. He says, there are those who rebel against the light. They do not know its ways, nor abide in its paths. The murderer arises with the light. He kills the poor and the needy. And in the night, he's like a thief. The eye of the adulterer waits for twilight, saying, no one will see me. No eye will see me. And he disguises his face. In the dark, they break into houses, which they marked for themselves in the daytime. They do not know the light. For the morning is the same to them as the shadow of death. If someone recognizes them, they are in the terrors of the shadow of death. What do you make of it?
It's interesting, some of the ways it's translated in here. What are you reading from what translation?
That's the New King James. And in the new JPS, I've got, I'm sure it's very different again. It says, they are rebels against the light. They are strangers to its ways. They do not stay in its paths. Okay, it's pretty much the same.
Pretty close, yeah.
The murderer arises in the evening to kill the poor and the needy. At night, he acts as a thief. That's pretty much the same. 15, the eyes of the adulterer watch for twilight, thinking no one will glimpse me then, and he masks his face, pretty much the same. 16, in the dark they break into houses, by day they shut themselves in.
Yeah.
They do not, it's a little bit different, they do not know the light. And 17, for all of them morning is darkness, it is then that they discern the terrors of darkness. So 16 and 17, a little bit different in the NJPS.
Sure, that's why I was wondering what you were reading from. So pretty much the first couple of verses that you talked about were the same, but then we see in 16 and 17, you know, a little bit different. And what we're seeing here is that the verses that we read, the first couple of verses, is speaking about how the wicked prefer the night. Mm-hmm. Because at night, they're not going to be seen. They're masked, you know, by the night, and yet they mm-hmm. can be recognized in the daytime. And it's interesting that it talks about this, the shadow of death, you know, and it's the same Hebrew that's used
in the Psalms,
in Psalm 23, verse 4, that talks about, you know, shadow of death. You know, it's really talking about this deep gloom or deep darkness. It's different from the word of shech, you know, which we typically translate as dark in the Hebrew. And so what's being said here really, I think, is that where most people, and then we see this idea of the morning coming, where most people hate darkness and love the coming of morning.
They are not so.
They're the opposite.
You know what that reminds me of? You remember Fantasia, you know, with the Disney, the classical music, Mickey Mouse and so on and so forth.
Can I tell you something? I've never seen the movie.
Ah, you've got to see it. It's so cool. But Fantasia, there was one particular...
Isn't that demonic, that movie?
Well, there was this big, giant, you know, black demon. I suppose it was supposed to be Satan or something, rather. And it does this thing.
What is demonic, anyway?
Oh, let's not even go there. You know, we should do a program on that all by itself. You know, and Babylonian religion
So tell me about Fantasia. When you said Fantasia, I thought you were talking about the girl that sang on American Idol. But
I don't even know who she is. I don't watch American Idol. But what we do is we see I remember there was one scene where, you know, the sun sets and, you know, all the ghosts come out and Satan, you know, he's running the show and you know, they all frolic around in at nighttime around the graveyards and all these terrible things. And then near the end of it, the sun begins to sort of approach the horizon and he's beaten back, this big, giant, dark, demon-looking Satan black thing that he is, starts to sort of, oh, boy, can't bear that. Oh, the sun. Oh, my goodness. No, better go and hide back down in my gloomy depths because the sun just beats me back and it's as if the sun is the shadow of death to them. That's what it reminds me of.
No, it's and that's basically what it's saying there. It's talking about this, that for them it's like the shadow of death, where for us, darkness, you know, we hate darkness. We can't wait for the light to come for the wicked, you know, the coming of morning light, you know, ends their reign of terror.
Mm. That's exactly what happens in this particular cartoon. So now we come to, can we continue from 18? This is the one that's got me stumped. This is one that I found really, really interesting, Ira, because
I think this is one of the reasons why the rabbi translates it as being, I think these couple of verses somehow speak to him about the generation of the flood. But
okay, all right. So because this I had to go to a few different translations. There was something about this that I found really interesting. In my New King James, from 18 to 24, you got to ask yourself, who is it that's speaking here? Is Job all of a sudden agreeing with his friends, or is one of his friends speaking here, or is he pronouncing a curse, or is he complaining that this is what should happen? So the way that I have it read in the New King James, it's, and there are certain words here, one particular word which is in italics, and it is the word should. I've got, they should be swift on the face of the earth, on the face of the waters. Their portion should be cursed in the earth, so that no one would turn into the way of their vineyards, as drought and heat consume the snow waters. So the grave consumes those who have sinned. The womb should forget him. The worm should feed sweetly on him, Ira. Nom, nom, nom. He should be remembered no more. And the wickedness should be broken like a tree. And I thought, man, this is interesting. All of these shoulds are in italics. They're not actually in the text. I went to the NJPS, and instead of should, you know what they have?
It says may.
May. And you know what? I found it. That's an interesting thing. I think the NIV does the same thing. May they be. Oh, now here's a word. Flotsam. What is flotsam?
Flotsam. Flotsam.
Flotsam. What is flotsam? May they be flotsam on the face of the water. What's flotsam? That's a new word.
Flotsam, I've never used that in my vocabulary. You never heard of flotsam?
No, what's flotsam?
Flotsam's like kind of the stuff that, you know, that you just see floating on the top of the water. It's kind of like garbage, you know, like sea junk.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's that. May they be that on the face of the water. Right. May there a portion in the land be cursed. May none turn aside by way of, and instead of you know saying, oh, this is what should happen to them, this is what I think should happen to them, and yet Yehovah is not doing this, but if it was up to me, this should be happening. Instead of Job complaining like that, in the JPS, what it's saying is as if he's pronouncing a curse on them. May they suffer this, may they suffer that, may this happen to them. Which one do you think is true?
So I think one of the reasons why they have should and may there is because it's obvious that there's a switch here. It's obvious that he's starting to speak in a way that that this is what he believes should happen. And this is the way they should be treated, and this is what should be happening to the wicked.
Is he charging God with wrong by saying this is what should happen and yet he's not doing it? Or is he just saying, you know?
Well, we're going to see that at the end.
True.
We're going to see that at the last verse, and you want to jump ahead to the end.
All right, so I'll keep going.
So the literal translation, you know, when it says Kalhu al Pene Maim, you know, it just is saying he is swift upon the face of the waters. Their portion is cursed in the earth. He's not turned by the way of the vineyards. And that can be translated a couple of different ways, you know. So flotsam and this idea of being swift upon the face of the waters, if you've ever been on the water, you see that things move really quickly based on the current and things like that. And so It could be translated in the way that you're saying, but it could also mean it can even mean that he's so consumed with doing the things that he does at night, mm-hmm. and that he goes about very quickly from place to place, doing what he has to do, robbing, cheating, stealing, you know, breaking into homes, doing mm-hmm. whatever he does, that he doesn't even tend to the things that he needs to tend to, that his earth is cursed. And his vineyards are, you know, he doesn't even turn to his vineyards. He's so busy doing the things of wicked that he doesn't even take care of the things. And why would he have to? Because he's got all these other people, you know, that he's putting to hard labor and, you know, and killing and oppressing. So it could be translated that way, or at least in this verse. Or it could be back the way you said, it could be translated as he's saying, may this happen to him, or this should happen to him. And this is why I think that most of these translations did that, because they're just assuming from the context that now that he's saying that this is what should happen and may this happen to this.
So may, when you say may this happen, it leaves room for God to eventually work his sovereign justice. When Job says, well, this should happen, it's more like he's saying, well, it doesn't happen. I don't know why God is tolerating or ignoring this kind of behavior, because if it was up to me, this is what would this should be the justice of the situation.
I mean, remember,
I like may better than should.
Well, okay, you know, I can accept that, but yeah, in the JPS and some of the other translations, it says may.
There it is.
You know, so where'd we leave off here?
Well, Ira, may the worm feed sweetly on him.
Right. Oh, you like that one, right? The worms?
Oh, no, you like that one. I just thought I'd give that to you. There's a bit of worm chewing there.
So in verse 20, we see the word rechem, you know, mm-hmm. which is womb. And that can be a metaphor for mother. Okay. It could be. And these worms feed sweetly on him. He shall not be remembered and smashed like a tree. Actually, I have and smashed like a tree. Word smashed, it actually has this idea of being pulverized in a sense. What I think is being said here is that when we look at it in the context of what we're talking about, it would seem that this is a negative here. But I don't think he's speaking negatively, but he's speaking positively about how the wicked dies. In other words, he is not going to be really great food for the worms, because the worms have already been eating away at his flesh. He's already becoming emaciated and wasting away to nothing. What he's doing is he's talking about the swiftness of the death of the wicked, that they don't suffer at all.
They don't suffer at the end of their
words,
life.
Yeah, the words are going to feed sweetly on him because he's going to be full of the fat. Remember, we talked about that fat that didn't remain anymore. You know, the one that goes down to Sheol. But here he's saying they'll be fat and the worms will feed sweetly on him, that he won't even be remembered because, you know, his death will be so quick. So it speaks more to the speed and painlessness of the death of the wicked as opposed to
which he's suggesting is unjustified. He'd like to see them suffering there.
I think at this point he's saying that they're the ones that should be going through what I'm going through. I'm not the one that should be sitting.
Potentially. So I've got in the JPS says that. See, I knew you wanted to focus on the worms, but in chapter in verse 20 in the JPS, may the womb forget him. May he be sweet to the worms. May he no longer be remembered. May wrongdoers be broken like a tree. May he consort with a barren woman who bears no child. Now that's different. I've got a different thing in 21. What I've got in the New King James, for he preys on the barren who do not bear and does no good for the widow. But what Job seems to be saying is, may he consort with the woman who does not bear, so that he has no children. Is that what I'm understanding from the JPS? What do you got?
So I have he is the companion, the barren. He's the companion of the barren that does not bear, and the widow he does not to the widow he does not do good. So there's a reference to there's a reference in one of the commentaries to the fact that during the days of Noah, Noah. And that during other times, we even read about in biblical times, is the prohibition that God gave to us about the unloved wife. And that this could potentially be talking about him having, that this person has the two wives, the one who is barren, who gave him no children, and that's the one who he lavishes upon. And while the childbearing woman is treated as treated badly and dressed in widow's clothing. So it's just kind of an interesting, another interesting take on that verse, sometimes. And so I was just giving you the perspective from the one commentator who argues that this is speaking about the generation of the flood. There are other commentators that think that that's totally wrong, that he's just dealing with the concept of the wicked, like he has from the beginning. And this is why they would probably agree with you, you know, in using the may that we see there. May he be the companion of the barren that does not bear. And but it's the second part of the verse that really, you know, presents the kind of the conundrum in translating it.
Leave his widow deprived of goods. Yeah, no, you're right. So both of those are valid and plausible, I suppose. But that's verse 21. And then it goes on, and does no good for the widow I've got in New King James. Verse 22, but God draws the... Okay, so it changes again. God draws the mighty away with his power. He rises up, but no man is sure of life. You're not happy with that?
And God? Where does it say in God?
I've got... Oh, look, it's in italics. There's a good point. Okay, so let's look at the JPS. Says, though he, with a lowercase h, it's God, though he has the strength to seize bulls. Hey, now that's a little bit different, Ira. What's going on here? It says, okay, so let me read it again. Verse 22 in the JPS, though he has the strength to seize bulls, may he, lowercase h, live with no assurance of survival. But in my New King James, it says, but God, in italics, draws the mighty away with his, capital H, power. He rises up, capital H, he rises up, but no man is sure of life. Where do they get that?
That's what I'm asking you.
I don't know.
That's why I asked you, where do you have God in that verse?
It's not there. It's in italics. They've just put it there. They've put him there. They said, you'll just go there. Thank you very much. And we'll capitalize those H's.
Yeah. So what happens is there is some reference to the idea of bulls being very, very powerful, being strong and powerful, and there's some reference to that in the Tanakh, and so that's why they do that. But really, what it's saying is, and though he can drag the powerful in his strength, may he not rise and trust in his life, would be a better translation. They're just doing bulls because they're talking about a very powerful animal, and talking about the powerful avirim, the second word in the Hebrew there.
Okay. All right. So that's that. Very different. 23.
Where we see in 23, we don't see God specifically spoken of, but it's definitely speaking of God here now in 23.
He gives them light. And I do have a capital H. He gives them security and they rely on it, yet his eyes are on their ways.
Contextually, what we're seeing here is that we just talked about this wicked person that's able to do all these things. And he's able to drag the powerful away by his own strength. And so what we're seeing here, again, Job is talking about making a distinction about the difference between what he's going through as a righteous person and what should be happening to the wicked. He talks about all the things that the wicked person does, what should be happening to them, or may this happen to them. And he's kind of saying that... that in spite of everything, the things that should be happening to him instead invariably bring him success, in spite of the fact that God is watching the whole thing.
Well, this is the way that it reads. It says he gives them security and they rely on it, yet his eyes are on their ways. He
sees everything that they're doing, and that's the point. And this is the answer in the last two verses.
And they are exalted for a little while, yet then they are gone. They are brought low. They are taken out of the way, like all others, they dry out like the heads of grain.
Right. Actually, the word there is snatched away. It can be taken.
Oh, raptured. Away. They're raptured.
Actually, you know, oh, you want to really
Come on, they're raptured.
Well, you really want to get into it? It's the same word used in Isaiah 52:15, which talks about the nation shutting their mouths as a result of the servant. And it has that, it's just a different conjugation of the same verb, of this idea of snatch away. So it's the idea of shutting up. Yeah.
So shall he startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths.
Shut their mouths, yeah. It's that same verb as what we see here. Yikhafsun. Ken yezeh goyim rabim alayiv yikpitsu, which is the same verb. And then here we come to the last verse.
Here we come to the last verse,
which proves the entire argument that he's been making the whole time.
At the end of it, this is what he says, and it stands by itself. In my New King James, it says, "Now, if it is not so, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing?"
Exactly.
You happy with that? Okay, so...
Well, basically it says, "And if not, who will brand me a liar and set my speech to nothing?"
And I've got in the New JPS... surely no one can confute me or prove that I am wrong.
Right. So he's saying if what I'm saying is not true, who's going to come and call me a liar about this and tell me that, you know, that my speech means nothing? So once again, Job is arguing that the wicked strive for just what they get. In other words, they steal, they kill, and they oppress the poor and the needy, and they get what they deserve. You know, they have the swift death and everything else. But he's saying, I... who represent the righteous, we suffer agonies and long for death, which cannot come soon enough. And yet the wicked prosper and are undisturbed.
Oh, man, I can't wait to get... Oh, look, the maggot and the worm is in the next chapter. How about that? You'll be excited about that. there's someone who... Because he puts the challenge out, and it's Bildad, isn't it, that puts up his hand and says, look, I'm going to reply to that. I've got something to say at least. It's not much, but I'm just going to throw it out there. And there is there's some stuff there. Now, chapter 25 is a really short chapter. He doesn't say much. Next week, we're going to do 25 and 26. I reckon we can knock both of those over. They're both pretty short. But Job does then reply to Bildad. But this is the way that he ends it.
This is the way he ends it here. Bildad has some... You got to think that if Job had any strength, you know, in those six verses that we see Bildad next week speak... those are some fighting words. I think I'd gather up the last ounce of strength I have just to smack the guy in the back of the head.
We're going to see that next week. Oh, man. That's one. Honestly, Ira, I think that's one of the more mysterious, potentially confusing, kind of nebulous chapters of Job that we just did. Leave it to the listeners to read it over themselves and see what you make with it, but definitely consult a number of translations, because you'll be surprised at the differences that you'll find between translations as far as chapter 24 is concerned. But again, my friend, thank you for coming back on to Truth to You, Treasures of the Tanakh, Torah teacher Ira Michelson, my friend. Just quickly, how's the website? It's still under construction.
So we have the website up, but of course I was away. I was doing the whole wedding thing, and working with Rabbi Moshe and getting him set and some of his speaking engagements, helping him out with that. And so kind of back to the grindstone this week. And so we're going to start working on that. Actually had a couple of meetings with Rabbi Moshe about some of the things that we're going to be doing, not just with the website, but with a virtual classroom that I own. We're going to be bringing in, and we're going to invite some of the people like you have here, you know, because it's great, but we have a virtual classroom where people can interact with us live. And it'd be great to have people, you know, I mean, like even you and I doing something, and having Rabbi Eli Cohen, and we have Rabbi Moshe Goldsmith from Itamar, and Rabbi Avraham Kimbam from Jerusalem. All of these different people that are coming to the understanding and a willingness to teach some of these things to the nations, and disseminate Torah to the nations, and to give people a better understanding, people that are so hungry out there. So we do have Torah threads up, and we'll be starting to add more material over the next couple of weeks.
Excellent. And, so it is TorahThreads.com, right?
Yes, TorahThreads.com.
TorahThreads.com. Also, there is a Torah Threads page on Facebook. There is Treasures from the Tanakh page on Facebook. And there is the most controversial, if you want to be challenged, to Helen Back account. What is it called again?
to hell and back, a counter missionary response. And really, to hell and back is, you know, it's it sounds like a very controversial name, but really what it has to do with is, you know, if you read the very beginning Pin Post, it talks about my journey itself, that, you know, when I was a young boy in Orthodox Judaism, I'd often be chased home from shul, you know, having rocks thrown at me, being told that I was, you know, dirty Jew and I was going to hell. And some of those same people are back now. Now people that used to love me are the ones that are throwing the spiritual rocks and basically sending me back to hell. So that's where the idea of hell, to hell and back. What we're trying to do is give people a forum to come in and discuss those things that they want to discuss related to the Tanakh. So if somebody has a proof text that they want to bring for why they believe that that's speaking about Yeshua, and they want to be challenged on that and see what the Jewish perspective is on those verses, then we're open to doing that. We try to do it in a very civil and respectful manner. And you're welcome to come and check that out as well.
Okay, a little bit of controversy, a little bit of challenge.
Oh, there's a lot of... If you don't have thick skin, don't come.
If you don't have thick skin, don't go there. That's a Facebook group. But there it is. That's what you're doing. Thank you once again, my friend. We'll be speaking next week with Torah teacher Ira Michelson. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.